once more into the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And we need to tell you that The Personal Wealth Coach is not only the name of a radio program, this one, to be exact.
Just in case you were wondering if this was
one. It is this one.
It's this one.
And is also the name of a registered investment advisory firm that does wealth management for folks, people, families, things such as that. In Salado, Texas, registered with the Securities and Exchange Commission, but neither approves nor disapproves of our activities. Well, at least they don't disapprove of it too hard.
And at least they're not disavowing.
That's not disavowing.
Like, disavowing is different than approving or disapproving or
they don't
vowing.
Approve of anything we
they
do.
Don't vow us either.
But they don't approve of anything.
They don't approve, disapprove, vow, or disavow anything.
Even the IRS will approve of something. They'll give a private letter ruling and say, we approve of that.
Yes. SEC says in their letter, as an opinion, says this opinion is not valid in any way. Well, the IRS, when they answer your question on the phone, they say the same thing. If you call up and say, how do I do my taxes? They'll say, do it like this, but
that doesn't mean you won't get in trouble for doing it this way.
For having done it this way. This is just the way I want you to do it.
To gum it, okay. And let's see, what else do we need to tell you? The information we present on this radio program is, wait a minute, I said it's the same name as the registered investment advisory firm, and the same two guys are here that give advice.
We're still bald.
Yes.
Either there or here, we're both bald.
And
either place.
Let's see, what else is there in there? We advertise. No, let's back up. We don't pay for this radio program.
Right.
But we don't get paid to do the radio program.
Right.
We advertise for the radio program on KTEM. The radio program we don't pay for.
Is that a quid pro quo?
I don't know, Senator.
I don't think so, but...
maybe it's a pro quid quo.
That's one of those things that when we talk about the SEC regulates us, they said, you don't talk about the fact that you advertise for the radio program, and we do pay for advertisement.
For the radio program.
We can use that advertisement as we see fit, and we've decided to advertise for the radio program.
Have you ever seen fit?
I have.
I'm not.
Well, you've never been to the UK.
Fit is there?
You know, no, it's a very common term. She's fit or he's fit means something very real there. So I have seen fit.
You have?
Yeah, I've seen fit, and that's
the end
of the
sentence. Well, I was to the UK, but I didn't see any. I don't recall seeing fit running around.
Anywhere. Well, see, you just have to pay attention to the slang.
I got you.
Then you'll see fit.
Let's
see fit to pay attention to the slang, and then you'll see fit.
The information, well, first off, what we present on this radio program is not investment advice, even though we are the principals of a registered investment advisory firm.
Right.
It is educational information. The investment advice is given to individuals according to their individual situations, goals, risk tolerances,
all that
objectives,
good stuff.
And all other kind of goobly stuff that's good.
And education is telling you the difference between education and advice.
Ah, so we can just shut up now.
So really, what we're talking about here, what's going on in the world, we'll talk about that. We'll talk about generalities of how to make decisions in the financial world. But if you call up and you ask what fund you should buy, we're not going to tell you that because we don't know you. And if we tell you to do it, somebody else might do it, and it might be a really bad idea for them to do it.
Might be totally inappropriate. Hey, the other thing is, the information we present on this radio program has been obtained from sources this is my opportunity to use the word.
Say it. Deem it.
Deem reliable and consistent and accurate. However, we make no warranties or guarantees as to the completeness or accuracy of any information we present.
Okay. It's not quite too late to do a New Year's resolution, even though we are now February 1st.
New Month's resolution.
Yeah, New Month's resolution. I would like you all to resolve to vow or disavow something today, to deem something today, warranty or guarantee, that's up to you. But deeming just is going out of style. People don't go around and tell you what they deem anymore. And I think
it's good. But
let's bring deem back.
We are. It's called redeem.
We're going to redeem deem.
People do a lot of redeeming.
Yes, so let's redeem deem, because the redeem is getting more use than the deem. It's a horrible situation for
a word. Well, it's kind of like something we started in Texas and is now migrating across the entire English language.
Yes, another. The word another.
Right. You used to see the word another used to be two words, and other. and we combined them, the English language combined them at some point.
To another.
And Texas, we decided to split them, and we moved A off to the side, stuck a hole in there before.
Yeah, you have to use another word to lead up to it, hole.
Right, a whole nother.
A whole nother. That's new, but you're hearing it in mainstream news media coverage now. It's
right.
Not in the print media yet, but the anchors are using a whole nother situation. That means it's coming.
That means
the print's going to pick it up too.
Means Texas rules.
Yes, and you just think the next time you're reading a very formal statement from someone, that's a whole nother matter, Senator.
It is.
It is.
It's perfectly good.
And it's picking up, so it's almost proper now.
That was cool.
Yes. Words.
Well, you know we're the swing state. They talk about Ohio being the swing state or Wisconsin being the swing state. Nah, Texas is a swing state.
We have more swings in our state than any other state.
I mean, Bob Wills was the first Texas swing. He had Texas Swing. That was the name of the music that he had.
Oh, yeah.
And I think it's very appropriate. We are the swing state.
And somebody is calling to say, why don't you guys talk finance here?
Telephone numbers. 773-1400 is back in service.
It's back, folks.
You can also call 771-2463 if you want to try to remember that number.
Yes, 773-1400 or 771-2463. And we have a caller probably telling us to stop talking about words and use words to talk about the economy. So, caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, guys, enjoy the show.
You did?
There was an article in the Wall Street about a tool that the Fed's looking at for the next recession. And the article says they haven't used it since World War II, but
what tool?
They're going to evaluating capping yields on Treasury securities.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So how is that different from what they're doing now? I'll hang up and listen.
Okay.
All right. It's a different kind of tool. How is it different from now? Right now, the interest rate that they are with a lever, actually with a tool saying we're going to turn this dial and say this is what we're paying, period. The Federal Reserve, the reason why they can set their short-term interest rates, when they say all the news is about the Federal Reserve raises or lowers interest rate, it's because it's what the Federal Reserve pays to banks or charges from banks. So they get to determine what their fees are. They get paid from a bank. A bank comes to them and says, I need some money overnight. The Federal Reserve says, this is what we're going to charge you to do it. And they set that at their meeting. The Treasury securities interest rate is capped in a different way. They don't have a lever. They don't say, we're going to be the ones to charge this fee in all cases. But that's in essence what they're doing. And what it's saying is that they will be primary purchasers of U.S. Treasury securities if they use this tool. What does that mean? It means they'll show up at the auction and actually be buying debt from the government.
Or conversely, selling it. For instance,
or selling it.
It's important to understand something about bonds that is very counterintuitive. The higher the price of a bond, the lower the interest rate. The effective interest rate goes down as the price goes up, and the interest rate goes up as the price goes down. And it's a little – we could explain that in detail, but it would bore you and would cause traffic accidents.
I've got a really easy one.
What's that?
It takes about a minute and a half, so hold that thought. Can you hold it? Burn it into your brain.
Okay.
When you put a deposit in a bank, you're loaning them money. If a lot of people are putting money into the bank, the – bank doesn't have to pay a lot of money for that money. So you're put your money in the bank. It's a loan from the bank. The bank doesn't have to pay you a whole lot, or maybe they do. So you've got your money on deposit there. If you hear about another bank paying a higher interest rate, does it make you want to change banks? So the law of supply and demand says, yeah, on large numbers, unless you have a really good relationship with the bank or the bank has you wrapped up in so many automatic transactions in your bank account that you just think the hassle of moving is not worth it, you're going to want to move. So you want to go get that higher interest rate. And when you do, it causes the value of the first bank, of their assets, to drop because nobody wants to have deposits there. It's supply and demand again. When interest rates go up, people want the new higher interest rate. If you have the old lower interest rate on something that you have, people don't want to buy it from you. So that causes the price to go down. Unless you're about to hit maturity, that's when they're just going to pay you back the whole loan value. And then interest rates aren't that big a deal because you're about to get paid back the whole principal. If it doesn't default. Okay, so that was it. That was my quick supply and demand. Well, interest rates goes up, causes prices to go down
on existing bonds. Yeah, on existing
bonds.
What happens is, for instance, the average treasury out there is trading about 105 to 107.
Right.
And so it's because if you look at the coupon on those things, they have coupons up around as high as 6%.
Okay.
The coupon is the interest.
Is the interest rate. It used to be, this is a piece of history, a bond used to be a piece of paper with some perforated little coupons at the base that you would rip off, and you would take it to a person, and they would pay you your interest for your coupon. So we still call that interest coupon, even though there's no coupons left on bonds.
So the long-term treasuries were issued years ago with much higher interest rates on them. They're still paying that interest rate on the origination price, but the purchase price has gone up to 107, which means that the effective interest rate, it's called the yield to maturity, because it's going to decline in price between now and your maturity to 100. The effective interest rate is whatever the interest rate is you see posted as the current interest rate on that length of bond, that maturity
right.
of bond. And if the Fed goes out, and the whole idea is if, for instance, the Fed wanted interest rates to go up.
Yeah.
They could go out and purchase bonds. No, sell bonds.
Sell bonds. They'd be.
But if they wanted interest rates to go down, all they have to do is go out and buy bonds on the open market at 20-year maturities or whatever maturity. If the Fed goes out and buys a whole lot of those, the interest rate effectively goes down.
And let me give that in a way that may be easier to understand. If everybody goes out and decides that they want to buy a house right now and everybody applies for a mortgage application at the same time, there's a lot of that going on, but not everybody. If everybody did it, there's not enough money to go around.
And
there's not enough money in the banks to give these loans. So they start raising the interest rate. They're saying there's not enough. I got to raise the price. And this, if you think of a hurricane, you know, we say you can't price gouge. Well, you're allowed to price gouge in the mortgage market. If everybody's trying to get a mortgage, it's not probably based on a hurricane.
You'd raise the interest rate and the price would go down.
Right. So the interest rate's going up because if those banks are trying to sell old mortgages at the lower interest rate, other banks aren't going to want to buy it. You're not going to want to buy it. It's paying a lower interest rate unless they discount the price so that the interest rate that is paying, that amount that's coming out, is enough to make up the difference. And so you just have to buy a discounted, you know, another way of looking at this may be a better, easier, all around. If you have a rental house and everybody's got rental houses in the area, people are renting from you, they're paying you $100 a month. A new house comes in. People want to stay at that house instead. You want to sell your rental house. Well, you're going to have to lower your price or spend some money to bring your house up. The new house has the higher interest. And literally, you're more interested in that new house because it's newer. It's a more comfortable situation. When interest rates go up on a new entity, whether it's a new item or a higher interest, you're more likely to buy that thing than the old thing, which causes the old thing's price to drop. Interest on money is very, very, it's paid, the original use of the word interest on money is paying a bank to be interested in you. It was a fee you paid the bank, not the other way around. And that's a fascinating thing.
Bottom line to it is they have the ability to go out and buy bonds on the open market to lower interest rates. So, for instance, if the interest rate on the 10-year bond gets too high and is going to slow the economy down, they can go out on the open market and buy 10-year bonds. Now,
they haven't done that in a long time.
They haven't done it since World War II. They buy short-term and buy and sell short-term treasuries, but they haven't gone out and manipulated the long-term rates. That's been left to the open market.
Now, this is a fascinating piece of history. when they buy on the open market or sell on the open market, they don't do it the way you or I would do it. They have to do it anonymously. And when they are buying on the open market, they have to know who they're buying from. You don't know who you're selling to, but if the Federal Reserve is buying the bond, they need to know it's a U.S. citizen that they're buying the bond from. Otherwise, it's currency manipulation. It's the thing that we are chiding the Chinese for. That's more about foreign exchange rates if you're buying it from another country. If you're buying it from a U.S. citizen, it means that you're affecting the U.S. values, not the world value of U.S. dollars. And I realize that just took a complicated turn, but the reason why it's a fascinating piece of history is that when 9/11 happened, several of the firms that were used by the Federal Reserve for that disappeared. Now, the Federal Reserve hasn't been using this tool for a while.
Well, not since World War II.
Not since World War II, but they need to have the ability to use the tool at any given time. So there was a bit of a scramble right after 9/11 to find another firm that was big enough that would allow the Fed to buy and sell and capable of telling the Fed if it was a U.S. citizen that they were buying or selling to. So it's a little bit weird, but that was one of the panics in the financial world right after 9/11. Is what if we need to use this tool? It's unavailable. It's a powerful tool. It's only used in very extreme situations, but extreme situations happen, and that's why we want to have it available.
Here's the interesting part about this, and I found several other commentators who, economists, far more well-educated than I am. The reason the Federal Reserve has to consider that, and the reason they're having to pump money every week, even though they said they were going to do it for a short period of time, ever since September, they've been pumping money into the short-term money markets every day, tens to hundred billions of dollars. And the reason they have to do that is because, very frankly, our borrowing at the federal level, our federal deficit, is out of control. I say out of control. It's authorized by Congress. But the point is, in the past, when we have borrowed this much money since World War II was an exception, we have bought the Federal Reserve, not the Federal Reserve, but the Treasury has gone in and borrowed money because of large deficits during economic downturns when there was ample money to borrow because nobody wanted to borrow money because they were scared. The banks didn't want to loan money to anyone other than the most secure creditors. And sure enough, the federal government qualified. So the federal government went in and goes in during downturns and borrows a lot of money, gives it back out in various forms to either construction companies or the public or whatever.
Shovel-ready projects.
That stimulates the economy. But there's plenty of money to borrow during those periods of times because loaning is, that's the nature of a recession, loans not going on. We've never, other than during World War II, had an economic boom going on and borrowed $1 trillion or the equivalent a year. We are in uncharted territories with regard to the federal debt. With the federal deficit, and we just kind of calmly shrug off the fact that the total 2019 borrowing, not old debt, freshly borrowed money, was $1 trillion. Actually, $103 trillion.
Not 103.
No,
$1.3 trillion. Yes.
1.03 to be exact. I'm sorry. $1.03 trillion. We just kind of shrugged that off, and that's one of the things I really don't get. And I've been invited on this show many times, and I invite again some conservative who supports unlimited borrowing with the Republicans and the conservatives gone for now in Congress. This unlimited borrowing, deficits don't matter, who just a few years ago was up in arms and adamant about the deficit was too
willing,
high.
Willing to shut down the government over the debt ceiling. I just don't know what's going on.
I mean, the last government shutdown wasn't over the debt ceiling.
No,
it was over
not
the
this
wall.
One.
It was over
was
the
over,
border wall.
That was over the border wall. But before that, we had threats upon threats upon threats of shutting down the government.
And the government was shut down twice.
Right, because the debt ceiling. Now, they didn't mind borrowing the money. They just didn't like to pay the money. So nobody threatened to shut down the government over the bill that spent the money. just raising the debt ceiling to pay for the bill that spent the money. That's what everybody was shutting the government down for.
So what we have is the Republican Party and the conservatives were against excessive debt. And here we are in an economic boom where we should be paying back our debts.
With one
according to everybody's monetary theory.
One House of Congress and the presidency in the Republican hands.
Well, when we passed the bill, the spending bill that raised spending 18% by the federal government and
right.
lower taxes.
Right.
The Republicans controlled both houses of Congress.
Right.
And the White House. And I
this happened when Bush was president at the beginning as well, when he had both houses and the White House, debt just ballooned. Same happens when the Democrats have both houses and the presidency.
Well, now,
debt balloons. Except
I want to argue with that, because during the late 1990s,
that's when
the Democrats controlled everything, and we went to a surplus.
Newt Gingrich was in control of Congress,
right, in the
and
House.
The presidency was Bill Clinton when we had the surplus.
What I'm saying.
So we had the Republicans and the Democrats in fighting with each other, and we had a surplus. But when one party rules, we just have ballooning debt.
But what we had, well, here we have two parties ruling, and we have blooming debts.
Right.
And I don't, again, I want.
We just all agreed that that's okay. I don't agree with that.
I want to have somebody defend the Republicans' switch in position from we need to balance the budget when times are good, which is the way we do it in Texas.
You have asked for this specific conversation since the end of 2017.
And I've never gotten anybody to call.
Nobody wants.
Well, no, I got one call.
No conservatives want to battle on that subject, saying deficits are okay, but they're just letting it be okay. What was the one call?
We got the one call where the guy said that if we, what was it? He said if because of the, he basically said according to the Laffer curve, if we lower taxes, we'll raise revenues.
Except
well,
that we can see the Laffer curve. We actually plot that thing, and we lowered taxes and lowered revenue.
The revenue is actually up for the last several years, but it's only because the economy is
growing. Right.
And that's wonderful. And we did have revenue go up, but we spent much faster than we took in revenue. So
corporate revenue is way down for the government.
We're in a position where, yeah, the government is receiving more revenue, but we raised spending 18%, and we only had about a 3%
rise in revenue. Yeah.
And I don't know how that balances.
We were already in deficit spending to begin with.
I don't know how that's supposed to balance, but the Congressional Budget Office, everybody who's in authority in Washington now agrees that if we continue on the present track and we don't either raise taxes or cut spending dramatically, and by the way, cut spending means you cut Social Security, Medicare, or defense. Those are the only big ones big enough to have any effect at this point. We either cut spending or raise taxes, or we hit 100% of GDP in real debt, not counting Medicare and future Social Security taxes. By the end of this decade, we hit 100% GDP debt. It's in other words, if you make $100,000 a year, that means you have $100,000 in credit card debt.
Yeah, this is not like mortgage stuff. This is credit card debt.
I don't get it. And this is one of those things that...
Let me throw this out here. There's different kinds of debt. If this debt were for building bridges and roads and internet connections and dams, that'd be more like a mortgage debt. We're getting a lot of benefit from that lasts a long time. Most of what our spending is on, and I mean that very clearly, most of what our spending is on is entitlements. Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, government retirement. That's scary. And we have a caller on 773-1400.
Is he going to take out my challenge?
I don't know. Let's see. Caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Well, I'm not here for the challenge. I agree with you on the debt thing, but if somebody that, like, I think the last person that tried to educate the United States on the debt situation was Ross Perot.
Right. The but big sucking sound.
What's that?
I was quoting him.
That was about the Mexican trade agreement.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Okay, go ahead.
That was about NAFTA. Anyway, do you think if somebody with stature of respect or whatever, really got up on the soapbox and tried to explain how bad it is that that would set off a worldwide, financial crisis. And, you know,
set off a crisis, but it'll be a crisis before we fix it.
Who could it be?
If we had
I can't imagine a person that we all trust enough to stand up and have this kind of conversation.
If we had a Ronald Reagan who stood up and said, this debt is out of control, he was called the great communicator because he was. He was an actor, and he had a resonant voice. And when he spoke, it was like your grandfather telling you something. And people believed him. Even the Democrats believed him. So what if we had somebody elected with the stature of Ronald Reagan and with the communication skills of Ronald Reagan, it could possibly turn it around. In fact, what's probably going to turn it around is some unexpected event is going to cause interest rates to spike.
And everybody's going to go, this is not sustainable.
And what's going to happen, that means that when the debt rolls over, because during this administration, the borrowing has been very short term. We have not done long-term borrowing, although that is silly. We should be issuing 30-year bonds. But we're doing it in very short-term increments, which is why we're having trouble with cash in the money market systems, because the government is borrowing short-term and rolling it over every 90 days. And because we're rolling it over every 90 days, it's very sensitive to short-term interest rate changes. When interest rates change, if interest rates go up, if inflation, we have no clue why inflation has not gone up, but if it did decide to go up, then at that point the interest rate on T-bills goes up, and the interest on the borrowing will reach a point where it will become so immense that it starts to really start to take the government down. And at that point we'll have the crisis, and we'll take action, and we'll suffer for it.
That's generally when the statesman shows up to point at the problems that we already really messed up, and now let's rebuild.
You know, the alternative is, and we are becoming like this, by the way, we could become Japanified. Japan has cut, they have no massive immigration, and as a result, their population is shrinking, it's aging. They have 250% of their gross domestic product is debt held by the public, and their economy is stagnant. They're not going anywhere. Their GDP is at zero or a little below every year. We could go there very easily, and we could go there very easily through massive long-term debt and cutting off immigration, which is, and we're doing both things. We're Japanifying pretty fast, as a matter of fact.
Yeah. Did that help, caller, or just lay out dark, nasty?
It's a complex thing, and, you know, politicians, all they care about is the next election.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to politicize this thing, but a couple of weeks ago, Trump said possibly in his next term he was going to mention or attack, things like, the third rail, Social Security benefits,
mm-hmm.
and all that.
Yeah, cutting Medicare and cutting Social Security is easy, and he's going to do it.
Yeah, so it'll be interesting. I just, I don't lose sleep over it, but I'm certainly concerned about the long-term debt of this country, and it is that they've been saying for 30 years it's unsustainable.
Well, that's one of the reasons
pays attention. I don't know.
It is. It has not been unsustainable for 30 years, and that's one of the things. And if you've listened to us, we've said, hey, as long as the national debt is not growing faster than the GDP, we're ahead of the game. But
and
the problem is right now the national debt is growing faster than the GDP.
And it has been for
a while. Jeff and Jake need to run for president and solve this crisis.
This is one of the problems with politics. You can't get good people to run because you can mud wrestle with the pig, but the pig likes it.
Yeah.
You both get muddy.
I don't think, frankly, I'm not the dumbest guy in the world, neither is Jake, but both of us together are not qualified, in my opinion, to be president, because it's going to take a guy.
See, that's the thing, is that the only people that run for president are the people that think they're qualified for it, and by definition, if you think you're qualified to run for president, you're not.
Well, plus you guys tell the truth, so you're automatically out. Anyway, I enjoyed the show.
That was interesting. Thank you very much for the call.
Yeah.
And the telephone number is 773-1400, 254-773-1400 has been redeemed. See, I got to use Deem again.
You did. Well,
it was redeemed.
You redeemed Deem.
And we got another telephone call.
And I haven't even talked about the market yet.
All right, caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. You realize who I am already?
No.
Oh, I thought you'd recognize my phone number or something.
No.
I don't see your phone number.
No. Who are you? Are you the
Uncle
nemesis?
Mark, Uncle Grandpa Mark, Colleen Fort Hood, Stillhouse Lake area.
Okay.
And the principle everybody needs to study is the parable of the fig tree. Have you not figured that out yet? Exactly.
The parable of the fig tree is if the fig tree doesn't produce, it should be cursed.
It gets cut down.
Did you know there are male fig trees?
Did you know the parable of the fig tree means the generations where Israel became 1948 become a nation, sir? And this generation shall not pass before the end of that generation.
Well, I don't necessarily agree with that.
I'm not sure where we're going with that, but we're going to go on to the next subject here. Let's talk about the market.
I could even comment on that scripture that he quoted.
Yes.
Generation, by the way, means the people of Israel. In other words, the Israeli race, the race of people we call Jews.
You studied Hebrew.
Yeah, I did. And it literally means this race shall not pass away before the end comes. And the Jews are still around, so I guess the end isn't here yet. Anyway, let's talk about the market.
Yeah, let's talk about the market.
Somewhere here I have something about the market. Yes, indeed. Well, in case you didn't notice, and I'm sure a lot of people don't follow it day to day, it gets kind of boring after a while. The stock market went down. Well, actually, it stayed pretty much where it was. But the index, the S&P 500 index, which is we refer to as the SPX, which would give us a definition for it, dropped 2.12% for this week. That's significant. This is it had 1% swings twice during the week, and let me say, for the last several years, 1% swings have been exceptionally rare.
Yeah, during the nastiness of the recession, it was uncommon to not have a 1% swing, but it's been 6 or 8 years since we've seen that kind of volatility.
And on the 17th, it broke records again, and then it started down, and the overall cause appears to be the fear of the coronavirus epidemic. But the price of oil...
may also be Brexit happening. People are yelling about that. The price of oil is there. Brexit happened. That's a big deal.
Well, 4.8% drop in the price of oil is another strong indicator that something's going on, as is the fact that the Treasury yield curve is once again inverted. And why is all that there? Very frankly, there's an economic slowdown going on around the world, and we can pretend that the United States can stand on its own, and we don't need to be globalizing, and we don't need to worry about things. But there's a simple fact. In order for our economy to run at the speed that it's running right now, we need foreign suppliers and foreign customers. That's a simple fact. The mushroom effect, only 12% of our GDP is exports. Okay, we accept the fact that 12% is exports. Okay, the problem is there's a lot of domestic production in the United States that supports the company that does the exports. And so once you start having exports drop off and imports drop off, there's something wrong with the system. It is something that the stock market dropped primarily because they're looking around and seeing people like Caterpillar, which is a bellwether for the market, saying we see lower demand, we're seeing lower orders, and from everything we're doing and talking to our customers over the next year, it's going to continue to decline. And so Caterpillar traditionally has led the market, meaning if there's a lot of building going to go on, a lot of construction going to go on, then the economy is going to do better, and they buy equipment from Caterpillar, who's the leading manufacturer of construction equipment in the world. And when Caterpillar says we see our market shrinking and we see people not buying as much construction equipment, that's an indication that the economy is slowing, no matter what all the other numbers say. And the Treasury yield for the 10-year Treasury dropped pretty significantly during the week. So again, we're back. The reason we got out of the inverted yield curve, which traditionally forecasts a recession, is because the Fed lowered short-term interest rates down below that of the 10-year interest rates, not because the 10-year interest rate went up. Well, now the 10-year interest rate has dropped below the point. It's actually lower than the Fed's overnight lending rate, and that is seriously inverted. It isn't a huge differential, but when the government can borrow money at 10 years for lower interest rates than the Fed is charging banks to borrow money overnight, that means that there's a lot of people who want to loan money to the Treasury. And why do they want to loan money to the Treasury? Because they're concerned, they're far more concerned with the return of their money than they are the return on their money.
Right. And this is another possible concept on why we're not having as much inflation as would be expected with this kind of employment. We don't have enough cash moving around. That's why the Federal Reserve is having to dump cash into the short-term market. It's going into longer-term debt. It's going into 30 and 10-year debt. That's why the interest rates are so low out there, is that people are dumping the money into long-term stuff instead of taking it and spending it, which would cause the inflation that we're not seeing. And we have another call on 773-1400. Caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. We just have a few minutes because we have commercials, but you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. I was just going to mention, with this modern technology and these printers and all this different styles of ink that they have, you know, these forgers that get out here and forge money to make it look like the real money, is that a problem that we're having an issue in the United States with that kind of issue? And another question is, if you do so happen to get a $100 bill, you go on the bank, want to break it for 20s and 5s, and they see that it's counterfeit, and you didn't know anything about this, are they going to convict you for any kind of crime? You have a good day, sir.
All right.
The answer to the first one is it's very, very difficult to counterfeit a new bill because it has laser engraving on it. It has a little strip of metal in it that can be read magnetically.
Hologram inside
it's,
there.
We don't have a lot of trouble with
paper
counterfeit.
Well, we have trouble with it, but it's the older bills. If you have one of those older bills and you take it in and you want to break the 100, you need to put as much scrutiny into that $100 bills as the bank is gonna before you take it. If wherever you got that $100 bill, if it was from another vendor, another bank, it's very unlikely that that is a problem. If you got it out of an ATM, it's probably not counterfeit.
Well, you don't get $100 bills out of ATMs.
There's very rare ones that you can still get $100 bills out of. Oh. They're around Austin and.
Really?
Yeah.
Anyway.
It's like, I want to get $20. Nope, we only do $100 increments.
If you have one of the old-style $100 bills, there is a fair... It means you've had it a while, for one thing. And there is certainly a slim but real possibility that it's counterfeit. Now, let me tell you what does happen with counterfeit is people who are handling money very, very quickly don't notice a poor counterfeited bill.
Right.
In that case, you're just stuck with it. You don't go to jail for it unless because they have to show you were new. But there will be some stink.
There was a seizure by ICE this week on the border of $900,000 of counterfeit bills. And they were very easy to spot that they were counterfeit. They didn't look right. So it's not a problem in that regard. Now, the second question is more a question for an attorney than for us of if you show up at the bank and you want to break this thing and it turns out to be counterfeit, you're probably okay if you didn't know anything about it because you probably don't have a stack of these things in your wallet. If you've got 10 or 15 of them in your wallet when you're trying to break one of them, you're going to jail. And it's going to be a long time in jail.
It all depends. Again, if they're sequentially numbered and so on, if you happen to have taken money from somebody who paid you for something,
you better have a good story about who it was. You're going to have to say where you got the money.
You need to. That's why doing cash transactions to try to avoid taxation.
Yeah,
because if it turns out that you had no way of knowing that this was counterfeit and that's your defense, and it's a pretty good defense. The problem is, why were you dealing in cash at that level anyway? And the answer is you're probably trying to avoid income tax or trying to avoid giving a 1099 to the person.
This is an area, and the counterfeit culture is still out there. There are still issues with it the banks are going to figure out if it's a real money, if it's real money or not. You can, if you're dealing in money, and this is where we see a lot of the counterfeit issues, is Craigslist. You're meeting somebody to buy a bandsaw or a chair or a boat, and you're the one selling the boat. So you're selling the boat, they're buying the boat, they show up, and they have a stack of cash. And you say, whoa, this is more than I expected. They're giving you more than you asked for. You said, I'm going to sell this boat for $3,000. They say, hey, don't sell it to anybody else. I'll give you an extra $1,000 if you hold it for me. It's probably counterfeit. So do your homework on that. It's worth it to get a pen or one of the little things that you can use to test the money. And there's a whole series of different machines you can buy on.
And that's also why a lot of places won't take $100 bills.
Right.
The fact is that there's still some $100 bills floating around out there that are counterfeit.
Iran had real money, but the reason why it was real is because we gave them a printing press, a real one.
And paper and ink.
So what they made was real money, but it was still counterfeit. I just word nerding here for a second. We got to play some commercials. The word counterfeit is a reference to recreating coins. Just like defacing the currency is you're scraping the face of the emperor off to get the gold from the face, and then you can melt that down over time and then still pay with that coin as if it's the full value. That's called defacing the currency because you literally scrape the face off. Counterfeit is when you make a mold to make more coins out of rather than a pressed coin, which is what most coins are officially made. When you're pouring molten metal into a mold, you need to press the original into it. And what you have left after you've pressed it into wax or into clay is you have a fit. It's the counter of the coin, the
Makes
counterfeit.
Sense. And speaking of counterfeit, we need to do commercials.
All right. Yes, let's play some commercials. Counterfeit commercials, and we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. The big economic news of the week.
There's a lot of big economic news this week.
There's a lot of economic stuff going on, but I think the big news was the fact that in the fourth quarter, the first estimate by the Commerce Department of our GDP growth rate in the fourth quarter was 2.1%. Now, that's a thing that's very poorly understood. The economy didn't grow 2.1% in the fourth quarter. That was if it grew exactly the same rate in the fourth quarter, if it grew that same rate for the rest of the year, we'd grow at 2.1%. And the year's growth in 2019, again, its first estimate is 2.3%. And it looks like we've got a call, so we'll come back to this.
All right. Caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Oh, good morning. I'm enjoying your show. I have a question for you. Recently, I found out that Panama and I think Ecuador, too, they use American currency as their national currency.
Mm-hmm.
They don't even print their own. So my question to you is, how do they get our currency to use? Because they're not part of the United States, and they don't belong to the Federal Reserve System. So I'm wondering, where do they obtain this currency to use?
They're normal exchanges.
My question off
thank
the
you.
Air.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah. Well, I'm going to answer that.
Yeah, go ahead.
China uses the U.S. dollar as its purchasing for the vast majority of its overseas purchases. I mean,
they don't like the yuan to be exported at all.
So the world reserve currency, as it's called, is the dollar. And it's really not too bad a deal to have the U.S. dollar, which is maintained with phenomenal stability by the Federal Reserve. If you're a small country, rather than trying to have your own currency, it ensures that you don't behave fiscally in an irresponsible fashion. How do they get the money? They get the money by selling stuff to U.S. tourists and to the United States.
They do it the same way you get your money in your bank account. They get paid in that money. So it originally started with they converted their currency into dollars. They had a currency, And they, one of their largest trading partners at the time was the United States. Panama, in particular, gets paid a lot of money from foreign powers, foreign countries, foreign corporations, because they have this little thing that kind of cuts their country in half, this little kind of thin strip of water with locks and...
it's a very peculiar strip of water.
Gates, yes. And it's a very expensive... or very lucrative, depending on which direction you're, whether you're paying or getting paid. Panama gets paid in U.S. dollars by all of that. They accept U.S. dollars for transport across the canal. And anybody that goes across the canal, it is a toll road. It is a toll canal. When you go through, you pay your money. That goes into the Panamanian system. And all of those people that pass through there, and there are lots of people that pass through that canal. It's a pretty long process, a full day process plus some to get across the canal. And you've got to wait in line. That's part of the thing, is that it's not quite wide enough to have just a bunch coming through at the same time. You've got to be in line.
Well, there's actually
a lot of money pours into the system that way.
Actually, there's a lot of countries. Not only the Bahamas use the dollar, El Salvador, Somalia, Guam, Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe has its own...
The British Virgin Isles?
Has its own currency, but nobody uses it. Ecuador, you mentioned Ecuador.
In Russia, if you really want to buy something, you're going to do it in dollars, not in rubles. And that's something that's a throwback to a long time ago, but it is still a very real thing. And there are a lot of dollars in the world. And that's, we buy from a lot of people. This goes back to why we're considered a superpower. After the Marshall Plan, when we were in Europe, we were dumping a lot of dollars there. That's what the whole thing was. We were buying things in dollars and selling things in dollars. And the greenback was still what you bought things with. You can still buy stuff with dollars in a lot of places in the European Union. And it's a lot harder to go to a restaurant in Central Texas and buy a breakfast with euros than it is to go to Central France and buy a restaurant with dollars, or buy a meal at a restaurant with dollars.
But you could buy the restaurant.
You could buy the restaurant too. It's just a bigger purchase than you may have been expecting when you went in for your eggs and bacon.
The countries that use the U.S. dollar as their either official or semi-official currency are all very small countries. Some of them have like 100,000 people in them. It just doesn't make a lot. And they used to be U.S. possessions, and mostly they...
Yeah, so Panama, the whole canal was ours with a 99-year lease. Mm-hmm. So it made sense for them that their country was cut in half by our country. That canal was U.S. soil in the middle of their country.
And Ecuador once had a peso, but their government has become... Well, one of the things that happens, by the way, in de facto reality, is that when a government fails, I mean, even if the government is still functioning but they don't control the country, the dollar becomes a de facto currency.
Yeah, that's why they call it the peso. It doesn't pay, so...
Oh, come on.
Sorry, that was a really big dad joke.
But the secondary use of the dollar, for instance, if you want to buy oil in the world, you buy with dollars.
Yeah, that's the international currency for oil purchases.
And so one of the reasons that the United States has the power it does right now in trade negotiations and to affect trade agreements is the dollar has such a profoundly wide use in the world.
Yeah. Iran has for years threatened to stop selling its oil for U.S. dollars. But they haven't actually done it.
They're trying to find another currency that they can use.
What else would they buy it? What else would they accept? And there's possibly the euro, but the European Union does not want to be the world currency.
Yeah, they've made a couple of shots at it, but there's just not the stability. And the euro goes up and down in value a lot more than the dollar does.
We bought that privilege. The Marshall Plan was expensive. And we paid for being the world currency. The European Union would have to do something on that scale to get enough euros out into the population
for it to be
a world currency.
They would have to have a central government, which they don't.
They do not. That is right. Correct. And the Chinese don't want it because they want to keep their currency close. We're the ones for a while. We'll see how that goes. And we're about out of time for this hour.
You are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach, and we are an investment advisory firm that uses that does wealth management for families, foundations, and things like that.
Trusts.
And if you'd like to contact us off the air, you're certainly welcome to give us a call at 254-947-1111. Or
you can reach that same – it's voicemail during the weekend, but real live people during the week, during the business week. At 1-800-914-7526. It's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. You've got all kinds of goodies on that page. We've got recordings of the radio program going back lots of years.
To 1847, I think.
I'm not sure. Maybe the numbers aren't quite right on there.
Right,
we'll
right.
have to look it up.
I'll have to look that up.
We don't deem that number to be reliable.
Okay.
But you can also contact us through there, read our newsletter, sign up for our newsletter. If you use the contact form, that's fine. You can also email us directly, jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. If you have a question for us to answer on the radio and don't want your voice on the air, we get a lot of that. We will talk about it. Until next hour, this has been the Personal Wealth Coach.